From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is Radio Boston. Coming up.
Since taking office, I've watched serious criminal cases against individuals accused of violent, heinous crimes grind to a halt because of a civil arrest by ICE.
Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins on her lawsuit over ICE agents in court. And how much power should prosecutors have?
We put prosecutors in this arguably difficult position. We tell them that it's their job to win convictions. We also tell them that they are obligated to be ministers of justice.
Also today, local reaction to yet another shooting in a house of worship, this one in Poway, California.
This is not Poway. We always walk with our arms around each other, and we will walk through this tragedy with our arms around each other.
We'll take your calls. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Middlesex County District Attorney Marion Ryan and Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins filed a lawsuit earlier today against U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, seeking to block federal immigration authorities from making arrests in and around Massachusetts courthouses. That comes as the Massachusetts legal community is still reeling from last week's announcement that U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling has indicted Newton Judge Shelley Joseph for obstruction of justice. Judge Joseph is accused of helping an individual escape out the back door of the courthouse in order to avoid being taken into custody by ICE agents. District Attorney Rollins says that ICE should wait until after convictions are made to make their arrests and asks that her assistant prosecutors to report any questionable actions by ICE agents to her directly. When asked at a press conference earlier today if she's concerned about her own actions and whether they could be considered obstruction of justice, here's how she responded.
I am in no fear of arrest. And very candidly, if I am, it would be my honor to be, because we need to stand up and be very, very bold about this ridiculous behavior that our president is engaging in right now.
Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins will join us in just a few moments. But first, we are joined now in studio by Emily Bazelon. She's a staff writer for The New York Times Magazine and author of the new book, Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. We are going to talk about the role of prosecutors in the criminal justice system. Emily, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, talk about the premise of this book. We know there are lots of players in the criminal justice system. Why focus so much on the role prosecutors play?
I think prosecutors have amassed tremendous amounts of power in the last 40 years, primarily because sentencing laws have ratcheted up punishments. But I don't think we've considered enough how much discretion prosecutors have and how they have mostly used it thus far to drive up rates of incarceration. But now we're also seeing this movement to harness prosecutorial power to actually shrink the system and increase fairness. So there is this general phenomenon of enormous prosecutorial power. And then the question is, what do prosecutors do with that power?
So you talk in the book about this sort of trifecta of power. You have prosecutors, you have the defense attorneys, and you have judges. And a lot of people think of them as being this co-equal triangle of power of sorts. And you say in the book that that has changed over time, that prosecutors have been given dramatically more power in this. How has that change come about?
So I think people have this idea that prosecutors and defense lawyers are like the bottom two corners of the triangle, and judges are up at the top as the neutral referee. But that's really not how it works anymore. Once you have a lot of mandatory sentences in place, you give prosecutors more power because what's happening is the punishment is baked into the charge, right? Prosecutors are the one who choose the charge. We started having mandatory sentences in every state in the 1980s. Crime was going up. This was seen as a way of eliminating discretion from the system. You're supposed to be tying the hands of judges. But you can't take discretion out of the system. What happened instead was that we gave it to prosecutors.
And we hear a lot about when we talk about criminal justice reform, about things like mandatory minimums and things like that being the place where the change is necessary. What changes specifically have happened that have given prosecutors more power? And where do you begin to examine their role in helping to shift that dynamic?
You know, I think the easiest way to reduce incarceration, if you're waving a magic wand, is to get rid of mandatory minimum sentences, because then you change the power balance back to what we had before, where judges are playing a greater role. But that's a heavy lift in a lot of state legislatures. I think what you're seeing instead right now is a social movement that is bubbling up in cities around the country, realizing that the local elected district attorney has this outside power, and then trying to make that person accountable to a different constituency. So you see communities of color, low-income people saying, hey, we're the people who are the most affected by the criminal justice system. We care about who the DA is, and we want someone in there who cares the most about fairness and proportional punishment instead of just locking everybody up.
So you talk in the book about this landmark case, Map v. Ohio, which basically applies the standard that evidence from an unconstitutional search must be excluded even in state court. But you also talk about the exceptions to this rule, which really sort of opens up a door. Talk about some of those exceptions. We all hear about you can't use fruit of a poisonous tree, but people may not be aware of these situations where you can.
Yeah, absolutely. So you might think that the rule is that if the cops stop you illegally, that evidence absolutely can't come into court. But the Supreme Court has created a number of exceptions, especially if they think cops are working in good faith. So there's a case recently called Utah versus Streep from 2016 in which the cops made an illegal stop and the prosecutors conceded it was illegal. They stopped someone just from coming out of a house they thought was a drug house. They thought they were doing the right thing. And so that was good enough for the Supreme Court. I think one of the problems with this whole area of law is that if the police find drugs or find an illegal weapon on someone, the idea that you're not going to get that person in trouble for it, it's kind of counterintuitive. And that has made these constitutional protections vulnerable.
So in the book, you talk about some principles that can be adopted by prosecutors after talking to a lot of the folks involved. You have 21 principles on them. I want to talk about some of them, including office culture. I mean, we don't think about office culture when we're talking about prosecutors. You talk about the impact office culture can have on prosecutors and the decisions that they make. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, sure. So traditionally, prosecutors have operated in an office culture where the thing that gets you rewarded is the big conviction and the heavy sentence. So, for example, I write about a prosecutor in Memphis where if you got a heavy sentence, you would get this picture on your door of a hammer. And that was like a good thing, right? Someone would take you out for drinks. You would come down hard on someone. That suggests that you're operating in an office in which that's the paramount contribution you can make. If we're going to change prosecutorial culture to reduce mass incarceration, we're going to need to start giving out awards for declining to prosecute someone because the stop was illegal, or sending them to an alternative program as opposed to jail or prison.
And you also talk about the use of bail and how it can often lead to a disproportionate impact. The less money that a defendant has, the more likely he or she is going to end up deep into the criminal justice system under the current bail system. Talk about that.
Yeah, so bail just blew my mind when I started reporting on it because I assumed we have this cash bail system where we have these private bail agents who have the power to haul people into court because we had to have it that way. It turns out that in Washington, D.C. and Kentucky, they've been operating without cash bail for decades. And it turns out most people just come back to court, that if you ask them to promise to come back, if you send them reminders, sometimes you have to connect them with social services. Those are good enough incentives. People don't want a warrant out there for their arrest. They understand they can get in more trouble if they don't come back. And so, unfortunately, we continue to have this system of cash bail, and its real primary purpose now is not to bring people back to court. It's to induce them to plead guilty, because if you're behind bars, you're going to be more likely to just sign the paper. Okay, I did it. I just want to go home.
And I want to get back to some more of these specific factors that are in play with prosecutors. But I want to step back for a minute and think about prosecutors. They're often elected officials. They're elected positions. And I want to get your take about how that might affect their decision making and their power. But also here in Massachusetts and elsewhere, usually the office of the DA is a springboard to higher office, or at least an attempt to seek higher office, whether it's a judgeship. You know, one of the Supreme Court justices is a former, at least one, maybe Yes, one. Sonia Sotomayor is who I'm thinking of, is a former prosecutor in New York. And you have people who have sought offices just for governor or Senate. Talk about how that political, that intersection between politics and law enforcement plays when it comes to prosecutors.
Traditionally, people have become DA and then use it as a springboard to move up the political ladder by being tough on crime. That was the politically smart and safe thing to do. It's just in the last couple years that we're seeing a different set of assumptions. We're seeing voters ask for something else. Because the system has ballooned so much and the fiscal cost and the human cost is so high, there is no longer, I think, a proper assumption that you can just be locking people up and throwing away the key and that's the way to make it in politics. So, for example, Kamala Harris, who was a district attorney in San Francisco, she is running for the Democratic primary, and it's turned out to be something she has to answer for, why she has this relatively tough on crime record. She did some things that she called smart on crime when she was DA in San Francisco, but she also did things like prosecute parents when their kids were truant. And some Democratic voters don't think that looks so great now.
And so does that mean when we're talking about all of this power that prosecutors have, is that power or can that power be checked by the people through their votes?
Yes. The power of local prosecutors is our power. And I mean that we, the people, like we vote them into office. If we don't like what they're doing, we can vote them out. We can create a different kind of yardstick for measuring the performance of a DA and demand something else. I do think that in the end, prosecutors have to give up some of their power in order to have really lasting reform. Because otherwise, if the reformer prosecutor gets voted out of office, you revert right back to the old system.
And you bring up in your book, you quote Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who is a former prosecutor, and she says, "We think we're keeping people safe from criminals. We're just making worse criminals," referring to folks when they enter the criminal justice system. Talk about what she meant by that.
So this is a deep insight, I think. We traditionally think the way you prevent crime is law enforcement, right? We think like, how can the cops and the courts make us safer? But actually, we know a lot more now than we did even 10 or 20 years ago about how healthier communities are the things that actually make people safe. And it's pretty intuitive. Like the kind of neighborhood almost everybody wants to live in is not one where the police are jacking people up. It's one in which there are good schools and there are jobs. And if you need mental health treatment, you can find it. These various pillars of really creating healthy communities make a huge difference in the crime rate. And the more we realize that, I think the more you can kind of take the pressure off this tough on crime set of assumptions for prosecutors.
And you talk about the cost, the cost of criminal being in the criminal justice system, not just in terms of the cost on communities and to the defendants, but in terms of cash. You write that in 2016, nearly 60% of federal defendants were detained before trial, with an average stay of 255 days, and that we spend almost $25 million a day, or $9 billion with a B, a year, to hold people who are still presumed innocent in jail. What impact do you think that has?
Well, it means we're not spending that money on things that could help people improve the circumstances of their lives. It's a choice we're making about where we put our resources. We don't have infinite resources. So when we spend $9 billion a year locking up people who, by the way, have not actually been found guilty of anything, that means we're not improving health care. We're not making the schools better in places where they live.
And joining us now in studio is Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much. And hi, Emily.
Hi, great to see you.
Yes, we are very excited to see you and today and tomorrow. She's coming to speak in our office, which we're super excited about.
And that's great. Delighted and looking forward to.
And so, as we mentioned at the top of the hour, the issue of ICE agents in courtrooms has been bubbling for a while. But this lawsuit that you announced today in response to Lelling's indictment, would you have brought that anyway, or was this brought specifically in response to that case?
It actually, the lawsuit that was filed today was contemplated over a year ago. I was not in office at that time and was completely unaware. I took office January 2nd of this year. On January 7th, there was an incident in Suffolk Superior Court where I personally called the Attorney General and said, I want to file an injunction or find out all of my options immediately. And that's how I got involved in this current lawsuit, which I'm happy to say was filed today, but I think, you know, I wanted it filed even sooner than this, but I'm very excited it was today. But it was not in response to what happened last week. It was in the works prior to that.
And as a reminder, last week, U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling indicted Judge Shelley Joseph for obstruction of justice. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey called it a radical and politically motivated attack. What did you make of the indictment?
I was very surprised as well. I thought the Attorney General's comments were accurate. But I think what we're doing today is much different than what is alleged by that state district court judge. We are utilizing the system to challenge what we believe is unlawful. And so much has been made, for example, about the fact that in my memo, I directed my staff to let me know when ICE was in our courthouses and was actually asked today by a member of the media, am I afraid of being arrested? No, number one. But number two, directing my staff to let me know what is happening and essentially in our workplace is completely appropriate for me to do as an employer of anyone, but certainly 300 people and as the chief law enforcement officer of Suffolk County. ICE is not letting us know, certainly, when they go in and detain people. And if those are defendants, please understand, I have an obligation to victims. These arrests are civil arrests. Right. A lot of people that aren't lawyers don't understand that. That is a standard significantly lower than the criminal charges that I am bringing against these individuals. We have child rapists that were removed prior to a victim being told this information, which violates our Victim Rights Act in Massachusetts. And who do you think has to tell those victims that they no longer have their day in court and the defendant's gone? It's not ICE. It's the DA's office. So we aren't communicating with each other appropriately, but we are utilizing the system, the legal system, to challenge what we believe is unlawful.
Now, one argument that is made by ICE is that by detaining people in courthouses where they've gone through security, they're less likely to be armed and they're in a secure space. It is safer in a lot of cases than trying to detain them elsewhere, where officers or members of the public could be put in danger during that encounter. What do you say to that argument?
I say to that they can utilize the training, the significant training that they need if they want to watch people and see after they leave courthouses. What we're asking for is not inside the courthouses, not on the stairs, not in the parking lots. And there's common law practice for centuries, right, that this has been happening. This is a violation, we believe, of the 10th Amendment as well. So for me, I would ask them to use their training and skill to watch this individual. And whether it's a mile from the courthouse, if they want to do that, they can. But my point is that where we conduct our business, people need to feel comfortable coming in there. Like churches, like schools, like hospitals, courthouses should be places where people feel comfortable coming and being truthful and not being in fear of being detained if they're a victim, a witness, or even the defendant. And certainly understand, even for civil matters, right? If you want to section a loved one for a mental health issue or a substance abuse issue, but you're not going to do that because you're afraid you might be detained or deported or they, and similarly domestic violence. So there's a lot of things with restraining orders, for example, people aren't coming forward at all.
Now, I want to bring this back to the topic of the power of prosecutors in the criminal justice system and back to Emily Bazelon's book, examining the role of prosecutors and the increase in power, because prosecutors, as you know, have say in a lot of things from sentencing recommendations to bail to how someone is charged to the high or low end of possible charges to what happens to them even after they're released. Do you see the power of prosecutors as a prosecutor? Do you see that that has risen, and how do you handle that?
So I think we've always had this power. It's not risen. Why people are noticing is because people like me are winning elections and saying, Hello, United States. Instead of charging toward mass incarceration, which you had no problem with prosecutors using their discretion doing every day, now that we're slowly talking differently, miraculously, everyone wants to question the authority that prosecutors have. So for me, nothing's changed. What's changed is the people holding these positions are different and are smart on crime and are looking at a system that has failed over and over and over again, overwhelmingly the poor, overwhelmingly people of color, black and brown individuals. So no, nothing's changed aside from people in the position are now looking very different and thinking very different about the authority that we have.
Emily, you talk in the book about the argument that being too soft on crime, that taking some of these steps may be seen as being soft on crime, and that will actually lead to neighborhoods becoming more dangerous, actually the reverse of what folks who are trying to make change is seeking. Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I think that's always the fear, right? And we're primed to worry about that fear. You know, since the 60s, since Richard Nixon ran for office, politicians have been really successful in scaring voters about crime. That doesn't mean that longer sentences and locking people up makes us safer. We just don't have evidence that that's the case. We have seen in places like New York and California, the incarceration rate has come down and violent crime has also continued to drop. So I think what we have now is a system that has ballooned to such a gigantic size that this idea that we're deterring crime by continuing to punish people the way we are, there's just no proof of that anymore. It's like these things have become disjoined from each other.
And Emily and I were on a panel last week with Larry Krasner in Philadelphia. He made an amazing statement that I am now going to steal from him, but give him full credit, of course, is that somehow in the criminal justice system, we always look at the one example of the bad instead of the 95% of the good. And so he gave, for example, with oncologists, if one person dies, no one's ever going to say that that's a terrible oncologist. But somehow with crime, if crime continues to happen after we change things and make it better for the overwhelming majority of individuals that come in contact with the system, somehow that's wrong. So I think we need to be bold and loud about the fact that yes, there are going to be times when individuals that we might let out on bail make a bad decision again. But if the overwhelming majority of people aren't doing that, then we need to focus on those individuals as opposed to the one or two that might make a mistake or stumble again.
And we talked a little bit about, Dia, you said that folks just haven't been paying attention to the power that prosecutors have. There's been a lot of attention being paid to law enforcement, to police officers, to policies, including here in Boston, like body cameras and the accountability on the part of police officers and the role that they play in the criminal justice system. Emily, why do you think there hasn't been that same type of focus put on prosecutors, given the amount of power that they have?
You know, this is kind of basic, but police are super visible. They're out on the street. They wear a uniform. They carry a gun. Prosecutors are lawyers. They dress in suits like D.A. Rollins is wearing right now. They carry briefcases. They kind of blend in. And they do their jobs inside courthouses where most people don't go. And honestly, I think most people don't want to think that much about criminal court. It's not a place they want to find themselves. And so there's a way in which we've allowed prosecutors and the whole court system to just be removed from society, whereas the police are right there in front of us.
And also, I think, you know, the media plays a role. I'm happy that we're here today, but the media only shows us, you know, violent criminals that are coming into contact with the court system. As the DA of Suffolk County, the 35,000 or so cases I have, the overwhelming majority of those are in my municipal and district courts and are nonviolent crimes. But people don't know that, right? Because that's not the story the media is talking to us about. We believe that only the people that are being held in the House of Corrections or Department of Corrections are incredibly violent criminals. And those are the words, for example, that ICE always uses. But fascinating to me is ICE is arresting them for, it's a civil arrest. I know what violent criminals are. I hold them accountable every day as the district attorney. But I think that that's getting lost somewhere.
D.A. Rollins, you ran on a platform of reform, which you talked about a little bit, and you even published a list of 15 crimes that your office would not prosecute if you were to take office. Can you talk about some of those reforms and what's going on nationally?
Yeah. So what I said was we would not in the first instance prosecute. I think what people what prosecutors do often is immediately as a reflex, we prosecute. There, we have many, many tools in our toolbox, not just jail. And overwhelmingly, these 15 low-level crimes, non-serious crimes, are crimes of mental illness, substance use disorder, and poverty. And what I want to do is, in the first instance, look at the individual. Like, we are the emergency room, right? We need to triage and look at this situation. If this is purely a mental health issue that has resulted in you trespassing, let's get you the services you need for the root cause of your problem. We can do a civil stay-away order that does not require jail, right? And see if we can get you services so you don't come in contact with the system again. If you continue to do that, there are different buckets we can put you in. And ultimately, if we have to prosecute you, we know how to do that very well. All I'm asking is for these crimes, let's think of dismissal or diversion first, pre-arraignment, prior to getting you branded with a record and moving into the criminal justice system.
Now, you face some pushback from folks, including some members of the law enforcement community, about some of these changes since you've been in office now.
Yep.
How have you seen the culture change as a result of these policies? And what would you say to the critics now?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, when you propose something as a candidate, nobody cares because I was one of five candidates, right? I called a lot of people. Nobody returned my phone call because everyone thought somebody else would be sitting here is your DA. What I found hilarious is when I won, I think September 5th, everyone woke up and said, oh my God, who is this person? Googled me, saw this list that had been up for 6 weeks prior to me winning and said, she's mad, you know, or whatever. So for me now, we can disagree without being disagreeable. I frequently or occasionally speak with President Michael Leary of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. I often speak with Commissioner Gross, my state police, all my other police departments as well. So we have a good relationship. Even U.S. Attorney Lelling, as a courtesy, I let him know that this lawsuit was going to be filed. He's a former colleague of mine. We can disagree without being disagreeable. That's what I think is going to happen. And I'm always open to listening to suggestions.
And Emily, how have these the proposals that DA Rollins was talking about compared to what you've seen taking place nationally?
Well, I think that if you're going to run as a progressive prosecutor, these are the kinds of promises you're going to make. And they're pretty typical of what people in this group are offering. This is an alternative vision of criminal justice. And one kind of overarching way to think about it is the idea of making jail and prison a last resort instead of the rule that we assume everybody deserves.
And one of the issues that you also touch on in the book is not just about how it affects people with less money, poorer people, but also the racial divisions that come. What do you see prosecutors' role when it comes to the racial inequities in the criminal justice system?
You know, you can't talk about criminal justice in this country without realizing how infected it is by racial bias and prejudice. It's at every step. It happens with the police, and it also happens with prosecutors and the charging decisions they make. And so I think people who want to claim a progressive mantle are going to really try to address that problem because it's just deeply unfair.
And what do you see the solutions to racial inequities, D.A. Rollins, and how do you address that?
Well, first and foremost, in our courthouses, data. We need to gather who are the people that are coming in front of us. How are we collecting that data? More additionally, I have to take a responsibility as a leader of an office of 300 employees. What does my office look like? I inherited an office where approximately 87% of my assistant district attorneys are white. They are excellent lawyers, but I can assure you 87% of the people that we prosecute are not white. And we need to make sure that people from Chelsea, Winthrop, and Revere work in our office. You know, Boston loves believing that they are the epicenter of the entire global universe. We are part of four different sections of Suffolk County. We need language skills. We need different ages. I mean, we need a lot of diversity, not just racial and ethnic diversity. But I have to take account of that as a leader as well. It's not fair for me to say, I'm a woman, I'm visibly brown, I'm enough, and then surround myself with the same people that always get the same jobs. I have to look at my staff, and then I also have to look at the numbers and speak out and change when I see disparities.
Okay, that was Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. DA Rollins, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Sorry for coming in so late.
It's okay. It was a great discussion. And thank you, too, to Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Emily, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We have more reaction today to the attack on a synagogue in California over the weekend. Local Jewish leaders held a vigil at a Holocaust memorial near City Hall yesterday. I'm joined in studio today by two religious leaders in the area who have been thinking about what the attacks, like the recent ones in California, New Zealand, and Sri Lanka, mean for their own communities. Joining us in studio to discuss this is Rabbi Mendy Uminer of the Chabad Center at Chestnut Hill. Hello. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi. Pleasure to be on.
And also with us is Sheikh Yasser Fahmy, who is the senior imam at the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center. Hello. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, we also want to hear from you. What's on your mind following the recent attacks on places of worship in places like California, New Zealand, and Sri Lanka? Do you think they've spiked since then? Has your mosque, synagogue, or church or temple been taking greater security safety precautions? Are you worried about your own safety? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. Rabbi Uminer, and I want to start with you. I understand you know some of the congregants at the Chabad of Poway. Have you been in touch with them? How are they doing?
Yes, well, 25 years ago, as part of the Chabad Peace Corps, I spent the summer interning at Chabad of Poway for 3 months before their building was put up, and I got to know the rabbi and many of the congregants, and the K's were there. I got to know them, not very well, but I definitely recognized their face the moment I saw it and knew the name and her husband's name. And then when they dedicated the building, I flew back in to be there. And yesterday I spoke to one of the congregants, a dear friend, Dr. Tressman, who was there, and he shooken up. Obviously, his daughter was in the hallway only 30 seconds before the shooter started shooting, and he's emotional and shook up. But at the same point, it was interesting. I tried to comfort him, and he kept on reiterating to me how it was a miracle what happened, because it could have been much worse. There was 100 people only minutes later going to be there for the Yiskor Memorial Service, and if he had come then or if he had gotten out of the hallway with all those kids, it could have been devastating. So as much as he was worried and concerned and frightened for his children, he was also cognizant of the miracle that happened and praising the Almighty for the good things within the dark.
Now, this isn't, unfortunately, the first time we've seen an attack on a place of worship, on a synagogue. 6 months ago to the day, there was the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Are these synagogue attacks making you rethink security for your congregation?
Well, we're always rethinking our security and making sure that we're looking after the people that come to worship. You know, people always ask me, they say, do you think that increasing security comes at the expense of our primary mission, which is to be welcoming and opening? And the truth is, on the contrary, we think it goes hand in hand with our mission and in fact increases it. Because when people feel safe and secure, they feel and know that they're being looked after and loved and cared for. So we're constantly looking for new ways to strategize to protect the people that come to worship, yet at the same point make sure they feel loved and secure and know that it's a welcoming place for everyone.
Have you spoken with local police? Have they given you recommendations?
So we're lucky to live in the town of Brookline, which is an amazing town, and thank God for the service we get from the police. I spoke to the chief today, Andy Lipson, who's been remarkable and incredible. I think we're one of the only towns that has a special liaison for all the houses of worship. And Paul Cullicane is amazing. He's in touch with us constantly and emails with us. In fact, they were in touch with us Saturday right after the holiday when I opened the phone. There was an email for him Sunday morning by services in Hebrew school. There was a police car outside just to reassure the people. So we feel very blessed, and I would like to thank them and all of our enforcement for the incredible job they do with such challenges.
And just want to remind our listeners that we do want to hear from you. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. Sheikh Yasser, unfortunately, the last time that you spoke with us at Radio Boston, it was after another attack, the Christchurch shooting in New Zealand that killed 50 people. How did you console your congregation after that attack and now?
Well, first, I want to give my condolences to the Jewish community for what it just experienced, which is unfortunately a recurring theme that so many of us have to go through. And very often, we in the interfaith community, we're coming together when people are dying all too often. And this is really a scourge and a painful reality that all of us have to dig a little bit deeper to really understand. I mean, my community, as many others, are going through the same type of real trauma and pain of trying to understand what is going on. Why does this keep on happening? What are the solutions? What can we do more proactively? How can we be more present? How can we process this spiritually and theologically? And that's a lot of the care that we give, the guidance, and every community is suffering in the same very deliberate way.
And how have you been reacting or considering the issue of security versus creating a safe and welcoming space? Sure. As Rabbi Umener pointed out, that sure. balancing act, what have you been doing?
No, definitely. I mean, the question of security is a very important question. I think exactly as the rabbi mentioned, I mean, this is really a step and a measure to ensure that everyone who comes, we get a lot of visitors from all across the world that come and visit the space. So we want everyone to feel that they can be secure in the space and they can come and they can enjoy themselves without having to worry about what may or may not be.
Rabbi Umener, has there been any congregant who has expressed some misgivings about going to services given what has been happening? Have you seen anybody who has expressed that they'd feel unsafe?
You know, as a rabbi and as a Chabad rabbi, I've always been reminding them what the Lubavitcher Rebbe, blessed memory, taught us, that a little light dispels a lot of darkness. And in the face of adversity and challenge, we rise up and we become stronger. And I think that that's had an effect on all of us. I mean, I watched my dear colleague and friend, Rabbi Goldstein, who from his hospital bed, and in fact, continuing his sermon as he was bleeding, reminded the people to be strong and never to fear. I don't think that's a contradiction to protecting yourself. In fact, if you go harken back all the way to the Bible, we read about Jacob. And when Jacob had to confront his brother Esau and he wanted to kill him, he did two things. He prayed, but at the same point, he prepared to protect his family. So people realize that we have to be strong and we have to be resolute. And at the same point, we have to protect ourselves and our children. And I think that that's how most of the congregation feels.
Sheikh Yasser, have you heard of anyone in your community who's been afraid to go to mosques, afraid to go to places of worship?
I mean, definitely I've heard of concerns, and there are young people who've come and said, you know, maybe my mom said maybe it's better today that you pray at school, at the university, rather than praying at the mosque. But what's really been remarkable is to see the resolute nature of our community and to see that they are committed to being in this space and to honoring the house, the sacred space, the house of God, and to not allow anyone to make or compel you to cower because of what you believe in and because of what you are. I mean, these are very critical moments where people of faith need to dig very deep into their sacred traditions to understand the type of not only power and dignity and honor, but mercy and compassion that comes along with these types of moments of difficulty. Because it's not all a act and react and aggression and pain and trauma. No, there is certainly beauty in our traditions that shines very brightly in the darkest moments of the night.
Let's go to our phones. Gary is calling from Marlboro. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I belong to a Jewish congregation, and my feeling is that it is pointless for us to put up armed guards. Our buildings were certainly not designed as fortresses. We are a very active social and political congregation. We speak out on health care issues, on immigration issues. We're a sanctuary congregation, and we don't want to do anything to close ourselves off. We look to our government for protection, for professionals, and not congregants who happen to own a gun. What disturbs me the most is that the Homeland Security group that was supposed to be keeping track of white supremacists, who are the source of most of the killings and terrorist acts in this country, has been disbanded. I want to see my government protect us to keep track of these people. If we put an armed guard at the front door, they're just the first target. I want them to keep track of these people and protect us. I don't want to change my way of life or wall myself off from the rest of society.
Thank you so much for that call, Gary. Rabbi Umener, what's your reaction?
You know, yesterday in the morning when we came to services at 8:30 and my little three-year-old came with me and we had a police car outside because they wanted to reassure us right after what happened, although Brookline doesn't have the funds to do it constantly, and obviously we understand that. And my son kept on crying to me. He says, "Daddy, you know, why is there a police there? What's going on?" To me, you know, the hardest thing is how do we address this to our children, you know? As a son of immigrants, my mother and her family ran away from Stalin, where my grandfather sat in prison for being a Jew and for studying Judaism. My father watched his mother get murdered in Jerusalem in 1947 in front of his eyes by terrorists. And it's easy to say, you know, we have to rely on others. But I worry, how are we going to protect our children and ourselves? And it's not for me to get into this discussion on air, but I understand where people come from both sides.
Now, it's been reported that the bombings in Sri Lanka were in retaliation for the Christchurch shooting. How do you address this idea? I mean, in Scripture, there's this idea of an eye for an eye. But the Scripture also says, the Lord says, vengeance is mine. Some scholars think that puts the phrase an eye for an eye in a broader context, that it's not for man to do. It's for the judgment of God. Sheikh Yasser, what do you make of this fact that there seems to be some sort of causal connection here where violence is leading to more violence?
Well, I don't know the particular geopolitical realities of Sri Lanka and what's informing, which is a very tenuous space, that there's a lot of a religious conflict that dates back many years. And that's a reality that's certainly toxic. And I think that in many ways, what we're seeing today in the world is an increased, is a rise in a certain type of toxic identity politic that's increasingly compelling groups to say that for me to exist or for my community to exist, others have to be destroyed. There's this type of toxic othering that is becoming very vile, and it is the biggest threat. It's the ideology that does not discriminate, and it goes beyond religious lines and certainly cultural and other types of lines, right? So you have this nationalist discourse, right? This supremacist discourse, this exclusivist discourse, which says that We are the ones who need to be protected and preserved. And for that to happen, others have to be eradicated. And you see that language increasing when you hear the language of infestations at the border, right? And if, what do you do with an infestation? You have to eradicate, right? When you see language that says, for example, in Charlestown, Charlottesville, when you saw that, Jews, do not belong here, or there are too many Muslims. These people have to be eliminated. This is the language that is on the rise. And so this nationalism and this supremacy, this is the real scourge. And this is the toxic, deviant ideology. It doesn't matter where it comes from, whether it comes from a Muslim, Christian, or Jew, or atheist, or Marxist, it doesn't matter. That's the actual ideology that collectively we have to counteract.
And I want to get Rabbi Umener's reaction to you. First, I just want to remind our listeners, we are taking your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What is on your mind after these recent attacks at places of worship? Why do you think we've seen these spikes? Has your place of worship taken greater safety precautions, or would you like them to? And is this feeding into the wrong narrative? We want to hear from you. 1-800-423-TALK. But Rabbi Umener, what do you think about this eye for an eye aspect?
First of all, I would like to thank the Sheikh for his words and unequivocal in how we presented them. To be clear, as Jews from the day of our inception of our religion, the greatest value has been human life. And under no circumstance does a Jew violate that. And of course, we believe in self-defense, but we cherish every human life. And we actually believe that every human being is created in the image of God. And to me, anything other than that is sacrilegious to God. And I'll say something else, that there isn't one commentary in the entire Bible or all Jewish literature that believes an eye for an eye means literal.
Okay. What do you both make of these attacks happening on or so near holy days? I mean, the Christchurch shooting was on Friday, which is a holy day for Muslims. The Sri Lanka bombings were on Easter Sunday, and the California shooting happened on Shabbat, right at the end of Passover this past Saturday. These are supposed to be safe spaces, and these are sacred days. Sheikh Yasser, what do you make of that?
I mean, I think it's a strategy. I think it's a targeted strategy to try to strike fear and to terrorize people into thinking that, hey, listen, you will never be comfortable. You will never be accepted. You should always be unsettled. This is a very targeted strategy. This is precisely what the guy in New Zealand was saying, right? He went into the most benign spaces and benign places to make this point. He was actually, what most people don't know, is that after the first two mosques, he was going to a nursery. Right? His next step was a nursery, similar to this guy, Breivik, who killed 77 kids because he was concerned that they would grow up to be liberals, right? So this is a very demonic and toxic and deviant idea, which illustrates that seeks to strike terror into people's hearts. And this is a big part of the question of how we consume and we negotiate this topic in the public sphere, whether it's through politicians or in the media. The language, the narrative, how we actually address this question. Because unfortunately, we have a lot of officials today who are acting like using dog whistles and language that is really inciting certain types of behaviors and actions and feeding into a greater narrative that there has to be this closing up, shackling up. We have to eliminate. We have to destroy because your identity and the threat of your existence. You know, these are the realities that we have to be more thoughtful about, I believe.
And these, did you want to add something about the holy days?
Look, the reality is that we live in a blessed country where most people are full of love and care and acceptance. And I think that, as the Sheikh said, what they want to do is they want to instill a fear in us because they are the minority. And the easiest way for them is to hit our target when we're mostly there and when people are at a spiritual moment to strike fear for them.
And Rabbi Umener, this is affecting Christian communities too. I mean, we've talked about the Charleston church shooting. There was also in 2017 the Sutherland Springs, Texas shooting that led to 26 people dying. What do you say to the fact that this seems to be rising across across areas of faith. And what do you say to now that we've seen this kind of once unthinkable kind of violence happening?
I think that terrorism knows no boundaries, and that the moment you don't value human life, it's dangerous across the board. And I think as leaders, community leaders, spiritual leaders, we have to instill within our congregants and followers that every human life is sacred, and that love and tolerance is the way to bring us together, and that at the end of the day, we're all God's children, and God loves each and every one of us. And I think it's important that we tell it to our children, that we tell it to the kids in the school, and that we inculcate them with a love towards humanity.
And I also want to mention also the three black churches in Louisiana that were burned down over the course of the last week. We have Tom from Gloucester on the line. Hello, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
The point I would like to suggest is, you know, everybody is, ever since Charlottesville, people have been questioning, well, are these hate crimes? Are these terrorists? I want to suggest, no, they are traitors. My father was a Jewish war veteran of the Second World War. He risked his life to fight Nazis. And those people in Charlottesville, had they been marching in the streets in the 1940s, they would have been put in jail for treason.
Tom, I appreciate your call. We're running low on time, and I want to give Sheikh Yasser a chance to respond to how we classify these kinds of attacks.
Yeah, first, I really want to agree with the rabbi's sentiments that, you know, at the end of the day, our faith traditions certainly believe in the sanctity of the human life, and that in the Holy Quran it is clearly illustrated that the person who kills one innocent life, it's as if you've killed all of humanity, right? And if you save one life, it's as if you've saved all of humanity. So there's an inherent dignity and sacredness to the human life. And what's obvious today is this: there are people who care about human dignity and human life, and there are a group of people who simply don't care about human dignity, human life. They care about their own self-preservation. They care about their own groups or identity politic that is to be preserved. They don't care about everyone. And I believe that people of good conscience, Muslim, Jews, Christians, and atheists, have to come together to push back against this idea, and hopefully we can rise above this.
Sheikh Yasser Fahmy, who is the senior imam at the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
And Rabbi Mendy Umener of the Chabad Center at Chestnut Hill, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.